From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Our current political moment in the United States seems to be unprecedented. We have the type of president this nation has never ever seen, one who has refused to divest from his many businesses and thrives on conflicts of interest, who is under active investigation by the Justice Department, and who has actively encouraged a mob mentality among his base against people of color, immigrants, women, and other minorities. Those who support Donald Trump do so at all costs, and have a diametrically opposed view of reality to the rest of America. How did the U.S. come to be so polarized? One journalist, an academic who has covered every presidential race since 1964, has written a book attempting to answer this question. Bill Schneider is a professor at the Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University, visiting professor at UCLA, Brandeis University, and Boston College. He's written for the LA Times, The New Republic, The Atlantic, The Washington Post, Political, Reuters, and more. He was CNN's senior political analyst from 1990 to 2009, and he has been a contributor to Al Jazeera English since 2012. He joins me to discuss his new book. It's called Standoff: How America Became Ungovernable. Welcome to the program, Bill.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So you have a long view of American politics, particularly as it pertains to presidential politics, elections, and how presidents govern. We seem very surprised by what has happened just in the last two presidents we've gone from, or three presidents we've gone from, George W. Bush, who seemed at the time as the worst president we could ever have, to Obama, who seemed to the Tea Partiers as the worst president the U.S. could ever had, and now to Trump. But should this really surprise us?
Well, it's called backlash. Each president has produced the backlash against his administration. Backlash has driven American politics since the 1960s. You know, you mentioned the last three presidents. Obama was elected in large part because he was the un-Bush. He was very different from George W. Bush, who was fairly inarticulate and who had a very conservative and divisive view of politics. Well, what is Trump but the un-Obama? Obama drove a lot of conservatives in this country completely crazy. They thought he was an illegitimate president. They didn't like him. A part of that, of course, was racism. But Trump was elected in part because a lot of conservatives were just hugely angry over the Obama presidency, and there was a backlash. And so they elected a president who could not be more different from Obama than any other person in the country.
So in the long view, is this sort of backlash and back and forth between the ends of the spectrum normal? If you know, it seems abnormal while we're in it because we're talking about sort of long periods of time. But if you go back decades, is this how it's been?
It has been. And I trace it going back decades to 1960, though it probably was true before then. In 1960, we elected John Kennedy because he was the un-Eisenhower. Eisenhower was old. He had been sick. People thought the country was slowing down, particularly after the launching of Sputnik by the Soviet Union. So they wanted a president who was young and vigorous and dynamic. And that's one reason why in the closest election in American history, we elected John Kennedy. Well, you can see it each time. How did Jimmy Carter get elected? He promised never to lie to us. He was elected after Watergate and Richard Nixon. It happens all the time. Backlash is really a powerful force driving American politics.
Is there something unique about the American political system that makes it vulnerable to, or I should say, that foments this type of backlash?
There certainly is. And that goes back even further to the writing of the Constitution in the 1780s. The framers of the Constitution wanted a central government that was weak because they had just fought a revolution against the king, whom they regarded as a tyrant. And they didn't want a strong central government. So they created one at first that was so weak, it was unworkable. That was the Articles of Confederation. They had to throw that out, then write the current Constitution, which has been in effect since 1789. But it is different from any other country in the world because it creates a central government in Washington that is weak and divided and very often ineffective. We have checks and balances. We have separation of power. We have a federal system with conflicts between the federal government and the states. It's very difficult to govern the United States because we have a mandate in this country for weak government.
Does the power of public opinion drive politics more so than it should?
Well, I don't know. It does drive American politics sometimes more so than it should. Public opinion is very powerful, although I can tell you the people don't believe it. They believe they have no say in what the government does. But actually, they do have considerable say. Whenever the government defies public opinion, there's a backlash, and people will respond. You see it all the time. You see the power of public opinion in this country in many small ways, like 90% of jury trials in the world are held in the United States. Most other countries don't use juries. They use magistrates and experts, even in Britain, which invented the jury system. We have a death penalty because the people want the death penalty. In Europe, it's no longer acceptable. We won't use dollar coins. The federal government has minted $1 billion coins, but Americans won't use them the way in Europe people use euro coins, or even in Canada people use loonies, which are their coins for $1 or $2. Americans are by tradition defiant of authority. We were settled by runaways from authority in Europe, people who didn't want to live under a tyrannical government and who didn't want to live under an established church. So defiance of authority is something very traditional. And that, of course, is exactly what Trump does every day. He trades in defiance of authority.
So is Trump different from those presidents that came before him presenting themselves as an alternative? I mean, certainly Trump railed against Obama and seems to have made it his presidential mission to undo everything Obama did.
And I fear that that could be the pattern in American politics if we don't find a leader who can bring us together. You know, four presidents before Donald Trump got elected on a pledge to bring the country together, to heal the division in the country, which goes way back long before Donald Trump. He didn't create the division, but he took advantage of it. You had the first George Bush, who said he was going to be kinder and gentler than Ronald Reagan. He lasted one term. Bill Clinton called himself a new Democrat and the third way, and he actually showed the Democrats how they could survive in an era defined by Reagan conservatism, but then he got impeached. You had the second George Bush, who promised to be a uniter, not a divider, and the country was tragically united for 1 year after 9/11, when Democrats actually supported President Bush. Then he started the rollout of the Iraq War, and that ended up dividing the country more than ever. And then you had Barack Obama, who said there's no liberal America, there's no conservative America. He was proved wrong during his administration when the conservative America basically refused to accept him. Trump was not elected as a healer. That makes him unique. He didn't propose to do anything to heal the division. In fact, he got elected by exploiting the division in the country. That's how he got elected, and that is how he is governing. He continues to exploit the division every day.
So we have a situation where we have a deep polarization in this country and a president who is widening that polarization, who's widening the gap. But isn't there some semblance of objective truth out there? I mean, maybe because I identify openly as very progressive, while I have my critiques of Obama and certainly of Bill Clinton, it's difficult to understand the virulent hatred that you see on the right toward these little bit more liberal presidents, the hatred against Hillary Clinton. And again, I have very strong critiques of Hillary Clinton, but the kinds of anger and hatred from the ultra right towards some of these center liberal left presidents seems to not be grounded in much reality.
Well, it may not be. That's probably true because what happened in this country is we have a division, a polarization over fundamental values, matters of right and wrong. And you can't negotiate or compromise when values are the issue. You know, it used to be the case for a long time in American politics that politics was driven by a conflict of interests. In the 1930s, it was business versus labor. That defined whether you were a Democrat or a Republican. Differences between business and labor are differences of interest. They can be compromised. Differences of values, those are right and wrong. That's morality. Very, very difficult to compromise on any fundamental values. And that's the dilemma we're facing right now as a country.
So does, for example, an issue like abortion fall into that category of values where there's no sort of talking to somebody who's on one side of the issue? You either really strongly believe in the right to abortion or you very strongly believe that abortion is murder.
Well, that is exactly the debate, and that's abortion is at the core of it, certainly. I remember having a debate. You mentioned debating the issue. I once had not a debate, but I had a discussion with a Catholic bishop over the abortion issue, and he sort of shut the discussion down when he made this statement. He said, "I regard abortion as a form of human slavery. When someone supports slavery, you can't say, well, that's your opinion, and if you want to get yourself a slave, go right ahead. I'm not going to interfere with you, but I personally would never do such a thing." He said, that's how we in the church feel about abortion. We think it should be illegal and should never be allowed. It's a crime, it's murder. And it would be like my saying to you, go ahead if you believe in it and get yourself a human slave. We think abortion is exactly the same kind of issue.
Now, does that then mean that we have a situation here in this country where we're forever going to be whipped back and forth from one side to another? Because that's a pretty sad prospect. You mentioned something about a charismatic leader that could unite two sides. Have we ever had that?
Well, we have. They've mostly been military generals.
Oh,
Lincoln
dear.
even tried that. You know, I had a student raise his hand in my class once and say, "Is this the most divided we've ever been as a country?" And I said, "You know, young man, we did once have a civil war. 750,000 Americans died in that civil war, many from starvation and disease. But the fact is, this is the most divided we've been since the Civil War. This election, this year's midterm, is likely to be what I call the war between the bases. The Republican base is solid and behind Trump, and it's stimulating the Democrats' progressive base. It's going to be a war between those two sides. Independents and moderates, I'm afraid nobody's going to pay attention to them. They'll be like the third sex. Is there any way this can be resolved?" Well, historically, there is one way that America has always been governed, and that's in a crisis. If we have a crisis in this country, and we've had plenty of them, then suddenly people come together and everything works because of the pressure of public opinion, which says, do something to get us out of this mess. Just stop this problem. Solve our issue. Whether that's 9/11, when the country came together for one year, it could be the Great Depression, when the country worked very well and pulled together for a year. It was the civil rights crisis in the 1960s. It was inflation in the 1970s. We've had crisis after crisis. It was the launching of Sputnik in the 1950s that brought the country together. This country can be governed effectively, but only in a crisis. If there's no crisis, it doesn't work very well at all because it really wasn't intended to do by the framers of the Constitution.
One might imagine that the Trump presidency as a whole is enough of a crisis that people would be demanding change.
It certainly is for people on the left and for most Democrats. They regard him as totally unacceptable. And one reason for it has nothing to do with really ideology. It is the perception, it's not a belief, it's a perception that he is dividing the country. Someone asked me if he's the most divisive president we've ever had. Certainly in my memory, which goes back a long time, he's the most divisive. That goes back to about 1960. But my reading of history is the only other president who divided the country as bitterly as Trump is doing was Andrew Jackson back in the 1830s. From what I know of Andrew Jackson, having studied him, read books about him, he was a very divisive president who virtually started a civil war. He made a war on the back of the United States. And let me tell you something, if you go into the Oval Office right now, Donald Trump has put a painting of Andrew Jackson on the wall of the Oval Office because he's an admirer of Andrew Jackson.
So is there something beyond waiting for a charismatic leader that you propose we need to do? Because if government is designed to be weak and respond to, you know, from one backlash to the other and essentially foment polarization, are there countries that have a different model of government that work better that we could start considering?
Well, certainly a parliamentary system is different. Let me give you an example. In Britain, which I've studied extensively, I've done reporting there. Let me tell you a little secret about Britain. In the British government, gridlock is unconstitutional. You can't have it. In the case of gridlock, the government can't govern, just like our government in Washington today, even though it's all controlled by Republicans. Congress, the Republican Congress, does not give President Trump everything he wants. He hasn't got the wall because they're not funding it, and he's complaining about that. In Britain, gridlock is not tolerated because there's a principle of the British Constitution that we don't have. That principle is Her Majesty's government must be carried on. If Her Majesty's government can't be carried on, if there's too much division and too many roadblocks and gridlock, then the government falls and the British have another election, sometimes two or even more in the same year, until they finally elect a government with a decisive majority that can govern and provide strong government, which is what the British Constitution demands. We don't have any such demand for strong government. So there are some things we could learn, but I'm afraid it would require changing our institutions and our constitution, and that would be virtually impossible. Americans like limited government because they think government is a menace.
Right. Well, I was just about to ask you, if one looks at it from the flip side, a weak government can mean greater powers. As you said earlier, people have more power than they think they do. Public opinion counts for a lot. Doesn't that mean that our political cultures can, you know, that there's movement for improvement in our political cultures? There's a huge middle in the country that often doesn't turn out to vote, for example, that remains apathetic, that feels that they can't really make a difference, and changing our political culture, because we've had moments in the country where there's been, you know, many more Americans mobilized to do something than now. Changing our political culture can be a healthy thing, can't it?
Can be, and that's what happens in a crisis. Our political culture will change, and part of the reason is demographics. The country is changing. The population is changing. Democrats are frustrated by this because they say, why won't the Democratic majority finally materialize? They've been waiting for it to happen for a long time. Let me give you the answer. Demographics is long. Politics is short. Demographic change will take a decade or two decades or more to become effective. You have to bring people into the electorate. You have to give them the habit of voting. You have to show them how it works, and they have to mobilize. They have to rally. That will happen, but it'll take a long time. Politics can turn on a dime. It can turn in one night. I think Trump probably spoiled his prospects in the week when he started separating parents from their children among immigrants coming into the United States. That was a shock to most Americans and probably the most damaging thing he's ever done. And it may have changed politics for the election this year. It was a very short-term event. But demographics is something very long. Mm-hmm. What I write about in the book is the division between the old America, which is Trump's America, and the new America, which is Obama's America. The new America believes in inclusion and diversity. The old America, Trump, feels that's a threat. They call it political correctness, and they have contempt for political correctness. That division between the new and old America has not been resolved, but it's been building since the 1960s.
And in fact, the slogan, Make America Great Again, explicitly refers to that. Let's go back to this old utopia that existed for perhaps a certain sector of the American population. It's easy for a political figure like Trump to exploit the frustration that white Americans feel who worry about becoming a racial minority. But there are, of course, plenty of white Americans who are quite happy with a diverse country. But the idea of demographics is something that, do you feel political parties rely a little bit too much on? The Democrats might be waiting for a a diverse majority to start voting for them, but why can't they simply adhere more closely to their stated values and attempt to win people over a little bit more aggressively? You see a little bit of sort of apathetic backtracking out from both parties.
Yeah, you do. There's a great deal of political apathy. I always tell students, the United States of America has never really been about politics. We've been about money. The Soviet Union used to be about politics, but politics is not something central to most people's lives. What is central to their life is something that has a big impact on American politics and makes this country unique, and that is religion. The United States of America is the most religious, advanced industrial society in the world, much more religious than any country in Europe or Latin America or even Canada. The reason for that, of course, is that so many settlers originally came here seeking religious freedom, going all the way back to the Puritans. And in the 19th century, a lot of Jews came here to escape religious persecution. The people who came to the United States were disproportionately religious people, and they've preserved their religious values. So the result is that more Americans go to church or say they go to church. The ministers don't see them. They say they go to church. They say they believe in God and angels and Satan and heaven and hell, and they reject the theory of evolution. It's only a theory, they say. Religion has always been a defining feature and an exceptional feature in the United States, and now it's become a source of division, because what you find since the 1960s, or particularly since 1980, when Reagan became president and invited religious fundamentalists to join the Republican Party, what you see is that the easiest way to define a person's politics is to ask a simple question: how often do you go to church? Regular churchgoers and synagogue goers tend to be more and more Republican, whereas people who go to church or synagogue quite rarely tend to be more and more Democratic. And that division is becoming greater. In fact, one of the core constituencies in the Democratic Party is what I call the unchurched. That's roughly one quarter of Americans today who say that they have no religion. They don't adhere to any organized religion. That group is slowly growing over the years. Back in the 60s, it was about 7%. Now it's about a quarter. It's mostly young people, but it is a growing number of people who don't make religion the central part of their life. The problem is Democrats can't rally those people, because Democrats don't want to become the godless party. That's very dangerous.
I wanted to ask you a what if question. What if Bernie Sanders had won the Democratic nomination? Could he have been that charismatic leader that could have brought some of these sort of middle of the road Americans to the polls to vote, and even possibly brought over some of the right wing on common ground with people on the left on, say, issues of labor rights?
Yeah. Well, Bernie Sanders, of course, never trafficked in the middle of the road. He has always taken decisive and strong stands. But people actually like that. Bernie Sanders has one important thing in common with Donald Trump. They're both populists. They both understand public opinion.
And they're both the older white guys. We have to sort of admit that.
Yes, they are. They certainly are. Sanders, of course, is Jewish by heritage,
right?
But he doesn't practice religion. Donald Trump doesn't practice religion either, but the religious right supports Donald Trump in large numbers because he delivers for them. He's delivered two Supreme Court justices. One is unlikely to be confirmed. And the result is that they think, you know, we're not going to complain about Mr. Trump's personal values or his behavior because he delivers for us. Well, I think in many ways, Sanders in the Democratic Party played a role similar to Trump in the Republican Party. I can remind you that Trump got 45% of the Republican Party primary vote, and Sanders got almost the same, 43% of the Democratic primary vote. So both of them excited a populist appeal. And on some issues, like tariffs, they fundamentally agree. Sanders doesn't support Trump's current tariff policy. He thinks it's very risky and dangerous. But on the other hand, he does favor some protection, more protection for American workers. Both of them appeal to populism. And I talk about populism in the book, because populism can be both right-wing and left-wing, sometimes at the same time. Historians talk about William Jennings Bryan, the great populist who was nominated by the Democrats three times, lost three times. He was a radical on economics. You shall not crucify mankind upon a cross of gold. But how did he end his career? By defending the Bible at the Scopes trial because he was also a religious fundamentalist. Those are populist values.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Bill, and helping us take a long view of politics to understand the moment we're in today. Thanks so much.
My pleasure to be with you.
My guest has been Bill Schneider, professor at the Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University and a visiting professor at UCLA Brandeis University and Boston College. He's written for a number of publications, including the LA Times, the Washington Post, and more. He was CNN's senior political analyst from 1990 to 2009. He's been a contributor to Al Jazeera English since 2012, and he's covered every presidential election since 1964. His new book that we've just been discussing is called Standoff: How America Became Ungovernable. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our audio podcast on iTunes, and our video channel on Vimeo.